This is Hometown Heroes, celebrating everyday Americans who answer the call of duty.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes, and a visit this time in the land of enchantment with 95-year-old Robert Bradley of Albuquerque, New Mexico, originally from Minneapolis, Minnesota. It was graduate school at the University of New Mexico that brought him to this part of the country after World War II. He spent 25 years teaching science and social studies in Albuquerque public schools. And now, at age 95, he is the author of the new book, The Centurion's Manuscript, which we'll discuss a little bit later. We have a link to the book online if you want to check that out. Bob still owns a Springfield rifle similar to the one he carried during World War II in Europe. He had earned a sharpshooter rating and training, but ended up transporting, organizing, and eventually cataloging ammunition with the 691st Ordnance Ammunition Company in Europe. He landed in Normandy 3 weeks after the initial invasion, and when we left off, it was late 1944 in Belgium in that infamous European winter.
Well, I've heard a lot about that winter from a lot of guys who didn't have a whole lot of comfort from that winter, especially during the Battle of the Bulge. How was that winter for you? Did you have deluxe accommodations and a space heater at your feet, or how'd you handle that winter?
I was first stationed in a little village with some of the other GIs in a schoolhouse in the little tiny little town of Beaumale, Belgium. The people there were very happy to have us because we had rations that we could share with them, for one thing. And then I was moved. Somebody looked at my record and saw I had taken typing, so I got a job, and they moved me out of that town to a chateau, Chateau Lexy, L-E-X-H-Y, and we compiled every night a report on the number of rounds of ammunition of every kind that we had received that day and that we had issued that day. And that report went into headquarters so that the people in charge would know exactly how much ammunition of every kind was being used and how much was still on hand and how much was coming in from the ports. And that was what I did for the... Then they moved to another chateau, the Chateau Les Wallefs, and that's what I did the rest of my time in Belgium.
I'm just wondering again, as you're typing this and you're typing what you described, the number of rounds in, the number of rounds out, I'm imagining those numbers were pretty big numbers. What was it ever eye-opening just to try to fathom the magnitude and how huge this effort was?
Yeah, it was pretty impressive, the amount of stuff that was coming. By the fall of 44, all the ammunition we had stored in England was pretty much used up already during the summer, and we were getting stuff direct from the States with dates only a month old sometimes. So... And then we had buzz bombs, V1s. They were more psychological than anything else, but you'd hear them coming for miles. They sounded kind of like a motorcycle without a muffler, very loud, and you could hear them coming, and their speed was about 400, and most of our fighters couldn't catch them, and they were hard to bring down. A few of them fell in our area. Most of them were headed for England or for Brussels or for Antwerp. Especially Antwerp, which was a port.
So did that rattle you a little bit?
Yeah, it did. Made me very nervous. Especially when you can hear them coming for such a long time. Two or three minutes ahead of time, you hear this brrrr and whoosh. I was out one day with a crew of Russians when I first saw one of those. It was there was a low cloud cover, and I heard the noise, and I'd heard it before, didn't know what it was. And then here this son of a comes in and out of the clouds, just headed for somewhere else. I don't know where it fell. But I thought, oh, that's what those buggers are.
Yeah, that seems like that's kind of a helpless feeling because you can't really defend yourself against something like that, and you don't know when it's going to stop and come down.
Nothing much you can do. That's right.
Well, and on that topic, I know it's maybe it's cliche or it seems too obvious, but I've got to ask you, here you are, a 19 and 20-year-old kid getting into your early 20s. Were you scared? Did you ever wonder if you were going to make it back?
I was scared. I was. Yeah. Definitely. Yeah. Buzz bomb scared me, and I had to go on working. But, you know, the danger I was subjected to was nothing compared to what an infantryman's experienced every hour of every day. Nothing. It was mostly psychological, as I said.
Well, and speaking of, does the thought enter your mind, am I ever going to make it back to America? Am I going to see my family again? Did you wonder about that?
Not really. I never thought that. My thoughts were about that. Mostly just I was thinking of my own, but...
Well, and I brought up the winter. Can you put into perspective, I know it gets cold here in Albuquerque, especially when the wind blows, but can you put into perspective what that winter was like, how cold it got, and what you had to do to stay warm?
We didn't have it too bad, because, as I say, we lived in the schoolhouse for a while, and then I was in those two chateaus. Mm-hmm. So the weather didn't bother me, but it sure bothered our troops in the front.
So you didn't have to try to dig a foxhole in frozen ground, but... You probably felt some of it when you were outside.
Yeah, we do. We knew they were having it miserable. In the Hurtgen Forest and the approaches to Aachen, and, of course, down in the Patton's army, down in the Alsace-Lorraine area, they had it miserable.
Yeah, I've heard a lot of that misery from a lot of guys who were there, and correct me if I'm wrong, but I'm guessing that those guys, the guys who were on the front lines, the guys who you just described that you had empathy for, they wouldn't have been able to do their job and fight the enemy if you guys weren't doing your job.
Yeah, and we were very well aware of that. We knew that no matter how hard we had to work, it was necessary, and we were happy to do it. And our company always got praises from higher officers because we were really very efficient at what we did.
And you're typing up these reports that are basically an inventory of all the ammunition that's passing through this company. How big of a variety of ammunition was that? I mean, is it everything from the bullets they're using in their rifles and machine guns to the artillery?
You want a list?
Well, sure. I bet you remember a lot of it. I bet you could rattle off a list.
30 caliber rifle ammunition for the M1, mm-hmm. and for the old Springfield. They used the same cartridge. The bolt-action Springfield. And then we had small arms, 45 for the officer's sidearm, and 30 caliber machine gun belts, and 50 caliber machine gun. And our most popular item was the 105 millimeter howitzer, because that was a standard field piece. All the armies had loads of those, and they had bigger guns too, but the 105 was a standard. It was about 2 to a box, weighed about 100 pounds, 50 boxes made a load for a 2.5-ton truck. Sometimes we overloaded if we had to. But the 105 was the standard round. And then we had 240 millimeter. We had 8-inch gun and howitzer. We had landmines, anti-personnel mines, demolition block, TNT demolition blocks, explosive rope called Primacord, and what else? Smoke rounds. I'm sure I'm forgetting something.
Not much. That was a pretty impressive list. And I'm curious, as you described that, you had to know how much was available of all of those and where it was going. But what if you ever encountered the need to defend yourself? Did you have any weaponry at your disposal?
Oh, yeah. We carried the 1903 Springfield. The infantry got the M1. And then later on, they took the... They recalled the old Springfield and gave us an M1 carbine, which was kind of a pipsqueak weapon. Yeah. It fired a cartridge, which is more like a pistol cartridge, 2,000 muzzle velocity, I think.
And when you moved into that job of being a company clerk, typing up those reports and everything, did that make things any safer for you or no?
Make it any safer? Not safer, but just more comfortable. Because we were indoors most of the time, slept indoors, worked indoors.
And I don't want to leave anything out that's relevant to you. Were there any other dangers, hazards, or concerns that you encountered over that year you spent on European soil?
I wouldn't think so, no, not really. If the Germans had broke through in the Bulge, of course, we would have been up the creek, as they say. Because their idea was to sweep around and come down through Liège and Namur and sweep up and trap the, that would have been the 9th Army and Montgomery's British troops, Canadian.
I imagine that gives you a pretty strong opinion about the guys who were there fighting in the Bulge, the guys who held Bastogne, the guys who were freezing their tails off and freezing their toes and fingers and fighting the Germans in those places.
Oh, yeah. We, toward the late end of, I guess, early 45, they were running short of infantry. So they thought, well, what we'll do is we'll comb through the service troops and pull out people, give them a quick course in infantry training and fill the gaps that way. So some of us were a little bit concerned that we might be taken for the infantry, but no company commander would send a useful guy. They would pick out the goof-offs,
right,
and send them to the infantry. And so that's what happened.
So I don't want to get you wrong. Are you saying that your ability to type saved you from getting assigned to the infantry?
Very probably did, yeah.
Yeah,
probably.
So it could have saved your life.
Not many were taken from any outfit. You know, one or two maybe from each company would be about all they would take. But I wasn't too worried about it.
I'm sure in that time over there, you saw some more things that you never expected to see and maybe that you've never seen since. So as you're traversing that area, what are some of the things that you encountered that last in your memory, that you can still think back and see today?
Toward the end of the war, we were still hard at it, doing a report every night, and they told us that we were going to move out toward Germany, which we did, and that we were going to be replaced by another company fresh from the States. Surprise, they were black guys. And the army was segregated in those days, you know. We never worked with black troops before, except we saw black truck drivers, but we never associated with black people at all. And these guys had obviously been picked for their education and their ability to type as well. So they sat in the office right beside us and learned the ropes, learned how to do what we had been doing. And we got along fine. We had no problems with that. And then we moved on out, and we left that job to them. We moved on out into Germany.
So again, I don't want to put words in your mouth, but it kind of sounds like just that little experience there, you're handing off those duties to this new group entirely made up of African Americans, that it underscored kind of how silly that idea of a segregated military was?
Oh, yeah. I had grown up in a completely white environment. You know, I'd never known any blacks whatsoever. I met a few truck drivers in the early part of our time in France, and they just seemed like regular people to me. And I never had learned any prejudice at home, so my mind was clear for that. I was quite ready to accept black people on a totally equal basis.
You had mentioned earlier that before Japan attacked Pearl Harbor, you'd been following what was happening in Europe, that you knew about Hitler and some of the things he was doing. Were you aware at the time of what was happening to the Jewish people throughout Europe?
Somewhat. It was in the news to a degree. We knew they were being persecuted. We didn't know about the camps. We didn't know about the death camps or any of that. That didn't come out till after the war. But we do knew they were persecuted and that they were, many of them were trying to get out of Germany. And, of course, Einstein had come over, and that was big news. It was just this weird Jewish genius who had completely revolutionized physics and came to America as a refugee, basically.
Well, and I'm sure since you're in New Mexico here, you're very familiar with this state's connection to Einstein and the work that was happening behind the scenes that ultimately helped end World War II. I think that's something this state kind of takes pride in, right?
Yeah, we do kind of. It's a perverse kind of pride because those weapons are, you know, doomsday weapons, really. But we have Los Alamos, we have White Sands, we have Kirtland, and all of these people are involved in nuclear work of various kinds, weapons and others.
Even the AAA baseball team in New Mexico bears a nuclear nickname, the Albuquerque Isotopes. In Los Alamos, you can visit the Manhattan Project National Historic Park. And in the southern part of the state, at White Sands Missile Range, you can visit the Trinity Site, where the first ever detonation of a nuclear weapon occurred.
You can visit hometownheroesradio.com or the Hometown Heroes page on Facebook if you'd like to check out some photos connected to Bob Bradley's story, or if you'd like to order his book, The Centurion's Manuscript, which has been called a riveting piece of historical fiction. We'll get some of the story behind that when Hometown Heroes comes right back after this.